Only thing I ever ask is to keep it 100, no cap. I fun in line with the goats, been dropping jams, so go get a notepad. We celebrate wins, so let's take a toast. I don't know what the commotion's about when it's set in stone that we greatness, bro. This is success in the making, this ain't a joke. We take leaps of faith like we hopped off a boat, no cap.
Hello.
Hey, what's going on, man?
Nothing. Are they, so they can't even see us on here?
No, it's a podcast, so it's just audio.
Just that way.
Hey, man, welcome to my podcast, No Cap.
Yeah, man, thanks for having
me. No doubt, man, I'm going to do a brief introduction of you, okay?
All right.
So, hey, everybody, welcome to No Cap Podcast, where we keeping it 100% real, no capping, with straight up facts. So today, we have a very special guest with me. It's a dear friend of mine. You know, we go way, way back. Like two flats on the Cadillac. We went to junior college together. This is a friend that we've done ministry together. And I have had the pleasure of being a spiritual mentor to him at times. And he is now a married man, so congrats to you.
Thank you.
And hey, man, why don't you just tell everybody a little bit about yourself, your credentials, and, some background information.
Yeah, my name is Owen Michaels. I am a teacher, or a teacher's assistant, really, at a alternative school. And I enjoy plenty of things, from going to baseball games to hanging out with my wife and just, enjoying a good time. As a follower of God, I play guitar on the worship team at church, and that's kind of my ministry right now. And so, yeah, that's about it.
Well, awesome. Well, hey, we're glad to have you here. So today, we have some interesting topics that you have chosen, and those topics, as you know, are culture and society, guns, and also spiritual and religion. So let's dive in, to one of these topics first, and then we'll work our way throughout the, the podcast on the other topics.
Yeah, man.
So cool. So let's talk about culture and society, man, because that's, an interesting topic, especially because we live in a culture and society right now that is ever changing.
Oh yeah, especially with the whole COVID-19 crisis happening. Within the last, I would say, 2 weeks, we've seen a shift. At least I've seen a shift in, well, not a big shift, but a slight shift in culture and society. But people are still people. Humans are still human. So it's not that drastic, but I'd say that, society in general nowadays, it's kind of sad. You have, like the demasculation of men, I'm going to say this bluntly, what a lot of people, including my father, would say would be the pussification of men, or the pussification of America, where men have basically removed their cojones and, they're being more in touch with their feminine side and their feelings. Which, the feelings are good. It's good to be in tune with what you're feeling and stuff, but I think there's a bending of the reed where society is trying to turn men into women. And it's wrong.
For sure, man. Dig more deep into that. What kind of tactics and what type of methods do you feel society is using to perpetrate that on, you know, males?
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't know if it's more of a tactic or if it's just like a 10-year, 15-year push, slow push of like going more towards that area of trying to demasculinize men. So for a little bit of a brief historical context, the macho man kind of persona, in my view, came from, you know, two generations ago. So our grandparents' generation, or maybe like that generation, maybe a generation before. You know, back in the 40s, you had men, well, 40s and 50s, really, you had men who, whether it was World War II or Korea, and even Vietnam in the 60s, you had men who were called to go to war. I mean, regardless if you agree with the political reason, they still did it. You know, they were drafted, some of them signed up, they went to war, they came back, and, you know, they took care of their families. The men were the main breadwinner, and... Now, I'm not saying that women shouldn't be able to work. That's not what I'm saying. But back then, the men took care of it all. And so the man of the household was really emphasized. And that was every boy's role model, was their father back at that time. And then the 60s came, and there started to be a shift in society. And there's the whole Woodstock with peace, love, dope thing. You know, the 60s and 70s. So the children of these men that I just talked about are, you know, there's no war. With the exception of Vietnam, but Vietnam was a war that actually, it was one of the first wars that people started ripping up their draft notices and stuff like that. And then the 70s came, and, you know, there's not really a war at the time. There's more of a, you know, it's a, or lack of a better terms, in regards to the previous 30 years, it was more of a peaceful decade. And so, yeah, 70s came, and we haven't seen a draft ever since the 60s. So, but I mean, what I'm trying to get at is, ever since then, and I've talked to my father about this, but ever since then, men have really like lessened on the masculine side of things. And I mean, there's good and bad that comes with that. We'll dive into that a little bit more, but yeah. So from a historical context, like ever since like the 60s, there's been more of a, I would say there's been more of a slight push for men to, you know, get more in touch with their feminine side. And I could be wrong. I mean, it could have really been highly emphasized more in like the 2000s. I mean, a big push with that was the LGBT hype movement thing, which I'm not going to share an opinion on that specific topic, but with that naturally came more of a like a byproduct of that came the result of, you know, the man doesn't have to be this big macho dude. I mean, does that make sense?
Yes, it makes sense. I have, you know, researched some of the things you're mentioning, so I am, you know, very familiar with that. And if you viewers or listeners out there are not familiar with the information that he was stating, you might want to research that and, you know, get in tune with that the best way you can. So, yeah, man, I mean, you made some good points. I had actually a few family members who were in the Korean War and then also the Vietnam War. And also, you know, along with basically that narrative of what was going on in those time periods that you mentioned, based on what I've understood about it and what I've read and researched, it was a time where modernism was something that was in play in those time periods. And so, you know, like you said, you had a lot of the responsibilities that were predominantly based on the male bringing home, you know, the money and taking care of, like, you know, the household in a way where he's being the main breadwinner. So basically, just to kind of add to a few points you've made, and then I want to, you know, ask you some more questions and some more insight, and then we can continue to go on, is that, yeah, during that time, I believe it was maybe around the Great Migration or the Reconstruction period, that, or maybe before, or maybe in between those times, where the women's rights movement had rose up, and basically women were getting fed up with men just being in charge and having that position in society where they're seen as more dominant than women. So there's a women's, you know, I guess feminist movement that started, as we all know who know history. So basically, you have to touch on that. That was one thing, but also you had, I guess, slavery in America as well going on, which has to do with the Great Migration and just also the Reconstruction period, you know, the war between, you know, the North and the South. So, yeah, man, my point, that was what I wanted to add, but do you have anything, as we're talking about society, culture, that you want to add? And also along with that, do you feel like what I mentioned about modernity or modernism has a part to play in the demasculation of men?
Yeah, we'll call it that. To kind of touch on the demasculinity of men, I mean, so here's what you have. You have, I mean, the stereotype for being a man was you went out and did, like, you worked a job that like, first and foremost, you worked. You went to work. If you, like, scripture even says, you know, a man that can't provide for his family is worse than an unbeliever. Like, that was, I don't know if, like, U.S. culture saw that and took that, and that's the reason why men went out to work, but that is what happened. Mm. Like, back in the 50s, a man who couldn't provide for his family was, like, shamed. And so they went out and worked, regardless of if that was a factory job or they owned a grocery store or they were a salesman, you know, or regardless of what it was the man went out and worked. The man did a job. And I think that, I mean, so it's the analogy of bending the reed, right? The reed is bent all the way to the left, so you have to bend it all the way to the right to get it back straight. You've heard of that before, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think that's kind of what's going on. But I would counter the societal norm that right now is saying that, like, oh, well, you know, being a man doesn't mean that you have to, you know, be all macho and masculine, and real men should cry and, oh, no, all this stuff, which is true. And, like, I'm a crier. I cry. I process things through crying, but I don't do that in public. You know, I don't do that all the time. There's very few certain times and places where that happens. But when it comes to the macho-ness of it, I really do think that, like, that's not a bad thing, because that means the dude's in shape. You know? I mean, look at our society right now. We're fat. If you want to bleed COVID-19 into it, the main reason why a lot of these people are going to die is because...
Hello, bro.
Yep.
Hey, you cut off a little bit. Can you state that point again?
Yeah. So in regards to COVID-19 and all that, I mean, if I will definitely argue that somebody who is fit and in shape that gets COVID-19 with no pre-existing conditions versus somebody who is just straight up out of shape, again, with no pre-existing conditions, the one who is in shape will have a greater chance of surviving this thing than the person who's out of shape.
Interesting.
So, I mean, while we're all quarantined, I think this is a great opportunity to get in shape. Now, So we're still talking about society. Society right now is overweight. The obesity crisis in this country is disgusting. Now, I don't have a six pack, you know? I mean, I've got a little chub, you know? So I'm trying to use this opportunity to swing some kettlebells and to get in shape. Now, that being said, a lot of people who are viewing this may say, well, I'm quarantined or I'm self-quarantining, my gym's closed. I don't have anything to work out with. Well, I mean, that's just an excuse, because you can do push-ups, you can do sit-ups, you can do crunches. I mean, come on. I mean, you can do dips with your kitchen chair, you know, like prison style workouts. You can do that. If you really want it, you'll get it. But I think, like I said, I think this is a great opportunity for America to get back in shape instead of sitting around all day playing Xbox and watching Netflix.
Facts. So let's dig more into those points, man, because I believe that you highlight a lot of good key things. So I want to take a stab at those things and want to, you know, just add a little perspective on that, as you added already. So far as like, you know, exercise and diet and nutrition, yes, it is a time that I believe as well it is crucial for us to be able to take advantage of the opportunity to be at home or at a location where we're able to, you know, get in shape and, you know, do the stuff we need to do to upkeep the health. Because like you said, during this time, there's no excuse. And along with that, I feel like it's going to help somebody to sustain their health. And also, along with that, if they are dieting, then the important thing to note is that supplementation and taking herbs and remedies and even eating the foods that you can eat that are healthy will help you fight off, you know, the disease and help you stay healthy. And if you do get infected, you'll be able to, like, you know, Mike has said and like I had said, fight it off. And so,
right,
you know, my point is exercise. You know, I encourage you listeners out there to take notes of what me and him are saying. I'm not saying that you're obligated to do that, but for your own personal benefit and for your family's benefit, just take that in consideration. And also, yeah, the other things you mentioned about this, men, you know, being in a position now where they're being more feminine and in their ways, society is trying to, I guess, present or to push that feminine mentality on men, which I understand. Like, we're all human, we have emotions. For me as a man, yes, along with Michael, I'm not much of a crier personally, but there's times where I do cry and there's times where that's just not a thing for me. And so, yeah, it's just something that it's something has been going on for a while, like Mike said, and like we all know. And yeah, I just want to add a note to that point. It's actually been going on in Hollywood for a while as well.
Oh yeah.
And along with that, there has been a demasculinization of men when it comes to men dressing up in dresses to get roles. Now, a few examples of this, you can guys go look this up. Jim Carrey, to get on Living Color, he had to dress up in a dress. Y'all remember the famous show, Miss Doubtfire? What a movie, Miss Doubtfire.
Yep.
One of the famous comedians of our time. What's his name?
Robin Williams?
Yeah, Robin Williams. You know, he had to dress up in a dress too. Take that role. And then also, you know, Tyler Perry, Madea, Eddie Murphy, Chris Tucker, and so on.
All that stuff.
You know, like, there's other people that have took this practice, you know, of dressing up in dresses, whether it is to fulfill the agenda or whether it's just to get a role and not knowing they did it. So it's basically an image that is being put out there about that. So do your research on that as well. So, Mike, what are your thoughts, because I know you have some thoughts about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's more of a thoughts. I'm sorry, thoughts in regards to like the way Hollywood is trying to push this demasculinization of men thing.
Sure, but also let's backtrack. Have you heard of what's going on in Hollywood with the Harvey Weinstein case?
Yeah, the Harvey Weinstein thing where he was, you know, taking advantage of women for like his whole career.
Yeah, do you want to touch on that? Yeah. You want to give your perspective, insight on that?
I don't have a lot of knowledge on that. I haven't studied that thing specifically. I just know he did a lot of bad things to some women. But I mean, I will say this though. I mean, the people who are defending him. Like I heard a story of a guy who walked into Harvey Weinstein's Jewish, and so. Like, I heard a story of a guy who walked into a sandwich shop, you know, around here. It was a predominantly Jewish sandwich shop. And he heard these two women going, "Oh my God, that Harvey Weinstein, I can't believe what they're saying about him. He's such a good Jewish boy. He wouldn't do anything like that." So, like, his personality comes off as, like, that cute, innocent, like, good Jewish boy, apparently. But in all reality, like, he's doing all this stuff, you know, kind of like Bill Cosby did. Like, no one in a million years would have expected Bill Cosby to have done that to all those women. You know, that's someone, yeah, that's something you would think that, like, you know, some, I don't know, more creepy guy would do. I don't know. But not Bill Cosby. You know, maybe William Dafoe or someone like that. Like, you could probably, yeah, William Dafoe, all these women, yeah, I could see that. But not Bill Cosby, not Harvey Weinstein. Oh no, those are good boys. No, evil's in all of us.
Facts. So I do want to refer to some of your boys. what you did mention about Harvey Weinstein and Bill Cosby. So with Harvey Weinstein, yeah, like you, I've had limited, you know, information about that, but. From what I know from her, you know, basically the scandal of what he has been doing has been going on for years, and he's basically been paying off these ladies and organizations to keep it under wraps of what he was doing. And then eventually there's this one person that was a victim that actually recorded him, but she was working with, you know, the police to kind of like see what he was trying to do to the young woman. And basically after a while, once they saw that they couldn't get anything on him, basically they dropped the case. And basically the woman, like, she's smart, like, she saved a copy of, you know, the recording on another device so she can then release it later on when the time is right. So basically there was multiple women who were involved with being, I would say, sexually assaulted or abused by Harvey Weinstein, or forced to have sex, consensual sex with him to get, like, advancement in their careers and stuff of that matter. So with the whole Harvey Weinstein case, I mean, he's even, you know, took advances towards doing it to men. Like, I don't know if you've currently heard about the cases that have happened within the last year or so with, you know, Terry Crews, you know, the African-American actor who, the big buff guy, who basically,
yeah,
him, you know, he's married, and he was at this party with his wife, you know, an industry party. And basically Harvey Weinstein walked up on him and grabbed, you know, his genitals, and right in front of his wife. So basically, he filed a lawsuit against Harvey Weinstein, and he took it to court. And so that was one case. And then you have all these women as well. And then basically, eventually, with the Harvey Weinstein case, everything just kind of came out about that. And he finally, you know, he finally got what he deserved. But I don't know if that's really going to happen. Fully, But basically what I want to say in closing with that topic is just like the lady, I guess, who is involved with the Me Too movement. You ever heard of that, Mike?
Unfortunately.
Well, basically the lady who was a part of the Me Too movement, she was a victim of Harvey Weinstein. Basically, the encounter or the experience she had with her, I guess, prompted her to be a part of Me Too movement. And so that's another topic for another day, but I just wanted to, you know, I guess, unleash that topic because it is current events in society and culture. So, with that being said, we have some more topics to dive into. So, man, according to culture and society, and what you know up to this point, what is your perspective, in your opinion, as far as modernism and Christianity up to this point, now that we're in postmodern age?
Yeah, well, I mean, I actually think we're coming out of the postmodern age. I think there's we're coming out of the postmodern age and we're into this thing called the New Age. So it's getting even more progressive, if you will. So within the church, like, do you remember this show that was on for a couple of seasons called Preachers of LA?
Yes, I do. I did not like that show, but it was interesting.
So that's, so that is whatever you want to call it, postmodernism or New Ageism, infiltrating the church at its worst. You got a preacher coming up there saying it, like, this is prosperity. This is so bad it makes Joel Osteen face palm when he watches it. I mean, this is bad. This is people going, God loves me, and a sign of God loving me is the fact that I have a Mercedes and a Benz, and my biggest problem this morning was I couldn't decide which one to drive to church. Was my Mercedes? Or no, I'm sorry, my Mercedes or my Bentley. Mercedes Benz, the same car. Sorry, my apologies. So my Mercedes or my Bentley. So, see, if I take the Bentley, that one's silver and the sun is beating too hot on it. But if I take the Mercedes, that one's a nice green color. So, I don't know.
To the point,
sweetheart. I want to be. Yeah, I mean it's irate. It makes me irate is what it does. And like, if you're okay, so we've gone from Jesus dying on a cross, being risen from the dead 3 days later, and then ascending into heaven, and the whole message is all hope is in me. Boom. He goes up and is with the Father, Holy Spirit comes down on us, you know, you got the book of Acts, you got Romans, you know, and then it's so on and so on and so on. And you know, it's, if you read scripture, it's people that are dying for their faith, right? Literally, like after the death of Jesus, like the next three books and maybe even so on are people who are literally dying. I would argue the rest of the New Testament from that point forward is people dying for their faith, people struggling with poverty, and then taking care of the sick, taking care of the hungry, the widow, the orphan. And we got these people that are living in multi-million dollar mansions with like three to four luxury cars, you know? I mean, it's, come on, that's hypocrisy. I think that if you do claim to be a child of God, it needs to come with a sense of humility, and there does need to be a sense of helping your fellow human beings. And so I would say even something we're experiencing right now is with this whole coronavirus thing is just like anywhere from the celebrity down to the, you know, woman working at Jewel Osco, like everybody matters. Doesn't matter who you are. And that's something we're starting to see now, which is good. But how this relates to modernism in the church is that you got the idolatry of the pastor. Everybody wants to talk. You notice how everybody wants to talk to the pastor after church.
Yep.
You know, no one wants to talk to one of the elders or one of the ushers who passed the money bucket around. Everybody wants to talk to the pastor. And so the pastor is just the spokesman
like of the church. He's just the guy who preaches on Sunday. You got a whole board of people who make decisions as well. Go talk to them. You know, I mean, why don't you talk to one of your, like one of your friends in small group? Why does everybody charge the pastor after church on Sunday? So there's that, but also, and again, before I say this, I want people to know that I am on the music team or the worship band at my church, but there's become an emphasis of, well, if the music's too loud or not loud enough, or if I don't like the style of music, this just isn't my church. You know, we've become way too consumeristic with the church. And so the consumerism aspect of going to church to receive instead of to give is actually the big issue that I think the church is experiencing right now.
Yes. Absolutely, man. Thank you for, you know, sharing your points. And I just want to you know, respond to those points and just kind of like continue the dialogue with those points. So, man, like you're totally right, bro. Like when it comes to, you know, just how far the church has come, you know, and just from where it started, you know, as far as, you know, the centuries ago where, you know, Christ, he was doing his ministry and he was encountering, you know, people of different ethnic backgrounds and cultures and still doing his father's work. You know, it comes to the point where, you know, like we talked about, he was crucified and, you know, he died and he rose and then he went up with the Father and the Holy Spirit ascended on. So basically we can say and point back to the book of Acts, like you said, Acts 2, the day of Pentecost. But along with that, man, there's also just a notion and just kind of a direction that the church has kind of, you know, took in this current century, where you see the prosperity people like Benny Hinn, Joel Osteen, and so many other people, you know, doing prosperity so-called ministry, and a lot of times people are buying into this this image of okay, I have to give my money to the church and to the pastor, which I'm not disagreeing with. But if you're going to do that, make sure that you know exactly what you're getting into before you get into it. And I think a lot of people buy into the lie or the deception that these people are perpetrating in the ministry. And so, yeah, man, I would agree that a lot of times people focus so much on the consumeristic part of Christianity and of the church. Like I've experienced that myself a lot in a lot of ways. Like currently and most recently, when I was in college, for the past 3 years at, you know, Tacoma Falls College, in Northeast Georgia, I experienced where, you know, we would go to chapel. And it's basically chapel is mandatory. Mike, you know about this. You went to a Christian school.
Yeah, chapel's mandatory. You had to get a number of chapel credits a semester in order to pass or whatever.
Right. So, you know, basically that experience that we both had at, you know, Christian schools were very similar. And so the school that I went to, and specifically, it was the same. And we went to, you know, chapel. And it was required. And if we didn't go, they would fine us. So basically, it was basically a good deed that they wanted us to do based on our merit of showing up. So when I went to chapel a lot of times, you would see that a lot of times it was focused mainly on, okay, the lights and how dim or how, you know, bright they were. Or even sometimes this westernized white Christianity, which is focused on that aspect of Christianity and just really excluded all the other things that had to do with Christianity, what I experienced, you know, going there. And so I guess my point is with the church, we bought into just not only consumerism, but Western white Christianity. And then also just we have, I guess, as a whole Christian body, whether you're this ethnic background or not, we have a misconception of what it means to actually be the church outside of the four walls of the church or inside of the four walls. So we think that church just exists, you know, in a building with the pastor and with, you know, a body of believers. When if you look at the Bible, you go back to Acts or Romans, you know, you go back to Paul and Silas, or even Barnabas, they preached the gospel in the streets, and they had times where they did, you know, have church where they went from home to home. So it basically, you know, today I believe it speaks to where we're at now. I think God is echoing how he wants the church and society to kind of like get in tune with that. But also for the church, he wants us to get back to doing church the way that, you know, he has originally made it to be. And so,
right,
with that point, Mike, do you have any feedback or any interjections?
I mean, I don't think I have any. I mean, I have feedback, but like it's more to do with like the reason. Okay, so you were talking about the church being whitewashed. Now, for everybody listening, Dimitri's African American, Caucasian. I'm white. I'm so white that you can see right through me. You know, like I am the whitest dude you will ever meet. Like I know how to play the banjo. You know, I baseball is my favorite sport, along with second to hockey. You know, like just straight up white. Like I didn't like Dimitri got me to listen to rap music, but like other than that, like that's the only exposure I've ever had. Anyway, so with that being said, with my ultra whiteness, I will agree that the church is super whitewashed. I mean, you go to, and I'm not talking just from a cultural standpoint, I'm talking from just a standpoint of when you, like you were saying, chapel in college. Like, you would get some dude that would come up there in a shirt and tie and slacks with, you know, some brown dress shoes on, who has maybe never, ever, ever experienced poverty or any of, like, the true hardships that, like, majority of the world goes through. And it's, you know, sitting there, and I'm a pessimist, you know, straight up. I'm not an optimist whatsoever. So you got some guy sitting up there and he's trying to relate, for an example, a guy would get up there and be trying to relate like Jesus dying on the cross and like how hard that was for him, and trying to relate that to how hard it is to study for finals. And I'm just like, you're kidding me, right? Like, are you kidding me? You got people who are dying of, like, in third world countries of starvation, and you're trying to relate that, you're trying to relate the struggles that Christ went through to me having to study for finals. You're kidding me. I mean, it kind of makes my blood boil sometimes, because I'm just like, when, like, the church, yeah, the church being white. So you get what I mean by whitewash. I don't want to bring race into this, but I mean, we can all agree that there are certain countries in this world where those Christians are happy that they got to eat food and happy that they didn't get shot or killed that day. And in America, we're happy that, you know, we had our $15,000 wedding. You know, God is so good. You know,
that's like half of that's like half of a salary spent on one day. I mean, you know, stuff like that. Like, there's the value systems in all these different countries are very. We're in a first world country. Like, they're very different. We're in a first world country. Like, you know, I overheard a girl in college who claimed to be a Christian who said, if he doesn't make over $55,000 a year, I can't marry him. He can't support a family if he can't do that. And I'm just like, are you kidding me? You're kidding me, right? So I think that has something to do with some of the milking out or the whitewashing of the church, where it's just like, okay, so how about I fly you over to the Ukraine, or how about some third world country in Africa, where they're having to make food out of mud so their kids can eat.
Yeah, exactly. So let's expound on that point, and then let's transition. So let's talk about mission in the church, and specifically I want to touch on just the fact that in the Christian faith over the years, as you know, the gospel has been preached or has gone out to the nation. You've had different mission organizations or different church organizations. And, you know, it could be predominantly white, you know, missionaries doing this, but it could be any missionary. But let's just focus on just the mission in the church, as far as like predominantly white missionaries going over to, I guess, you know, whether it's Asia or whether it's African countries or the Caribbean. And basically when they go over to these countries, like, people who are there, they are maybe practicing a different belief system or religion. And whether that's good or bad, it's not for me to judge or to say. But, you know, you have this white missionary come over there almost with this savior mentality of like, I'm the white savior, I'm Jesus. And even though that's not what they're intending or that's not what they're trying to say, don't get me wrong, that's what comes off as that. And then you see the people in these countries watching them and start, you know, worshiping like they're actually Jesus. So that mentality, and I've talked to many people who have had this experience. Like my fiance, she is Haitian, and she talked about just that mentality being imposed on, you know, her people at certain times when missionaries would come to her church, or they would come to Haiti specifically. And also there's a story, many stories in Africa that talk about this. So I'm not going to get all deep into this or that, but yeah, man, I just kind of want to know your perspective on that point.
On the point of the, I like the white savior kind of trying to go save everybody.
Yes, what is your standpoint on that?
Yeah. So there's a book out called When Helping Hurts. Mm. And it's I forgot who was by, but it's a book that is about how predominantly first world Christians who I want to say have the right heart. So the white savior mentality, I want to be optimistic and say some of these people have the right motive in doing this. They just lack the knowledge of where they're going and the experience maybe into what they're actually doing. So this book is about when the white people come over to a third world country, and what happens? They bring clothes, they bring some food, they bring maybe some money, they bring stuff, and they go there, they go there and they drop off supplies, and they try to convert souls to Jesus. They're there for a month and then they leave. Okay, so I'm going to ask you a question. What is the number one job as a Christian?
Are you seriously asking me that question?
I'm asking this question. What is, like, what's the number one concern for a
believer? All right, I'm just gonna like, say clear and blatantly, Matthew 28.
Yeah. Right. And that's what, and what is that?
Well, let me pull it up. You know, if, let me pull it up. Give me a second, my viewers. I'm gonna pull Matthew 8 for y'all.
Here.
Just so y'all can know.
Matthew 28. Yeah. Yeah, I have it right here.
Read it for us. Read it.
Pull this up. Yeah, therefore go out and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything that I have commanded you, and surely I am with you always to the very end of the age. So yeah, go out, make disciples of all nations. That's great. How do you disciple people? Do you really think you're able to disciple somebody if you're there for a month?
Honestly, no.
No. So if you go there, so the white savior mentality is to, and I'm not bashing white people. The reason why I say like that as it is because a majority of your white people come from first world countries, and so the savior mentality of the first world or the white savior mentality, whatever you want to call it, basically says, I'm going to go over to this place. I'm going to give them all the stuff that they thought they would never be able to have. And then they'll become Christians. They will forget about, but the reality is that they, if you go there for a month and that's it, there's no like relationship that's happening. There's no fellowship that's going on. There's no discipling. Jesus discipled his followers, or his disciples. It was like what, 3 years? Like 2 to 3 years he spent discipling these people. Not a year, or not 6 months, not even a month. It took Jesus a long time to do that. And that's the reason why we call it discipleship and not church camp. Church camp is a fun experience, right? Discipleship requires a lot of sacrifice. And so if you're going to disciple somebody, it takes a long, long, long time. I argue that discipleship takes a lifetime. So this book called When Helping Hurts talks about how it actually hurts the people when you go over there and you basically remind them that they're poor.
Right. And go ahead.
And, yeah. And I was going to say, and dropping off supplies is great. Do that. But don't call that that's a good work. You're doing a good work, and God calls us to do good works. But if you're going there to win souls, you best be prepared to stay there for 6 months to a year minimum. Learn their language, learn their culture. If you're going to go disciple somebody in a totally different culture, the first thing that you do is you learn their language so they know that you care.
Right. So that was some good points you made, man, and you know, pretty well said. And I hope you guys out there who are listening and viewing just take heed and take note of what we're saying. And in transition, man, I thank you for sharing those points on that topic. There are some books that I do want to recommend to you guys on, you know, the topic of culture and society from a Christian perspective, and just from a culture and society perspective. There's this book by Sarah Shin. It's called Beyond Colorblind: Redeeming Our Ethnic Journey. So I recommend you, Mike, to check that out, and everybody out there that's listening, check that book out. That's a good book. Also, for those who are just honestly seeking to understand their identity as being a white person in America. There's this good book that I read in school last semester. It's called White Awake, and it says an honest look at what it means to be white. And so it's by Daniel Hill. So check that out.
Is it by a black guy or a white guy?
So it's by InterVarsity Press. So check that book out. I was a part of InterVarsity. Shout out to all my InterVarsity people. Also,
yeah, we were in
there. Sure. Let's talk about just the fact that when we look at, how do I want to state that? Our next topic is basically guns and basically, what is it? Correct me if I'm wrong. The 13th Amendment?
No, Second Amendment.
Okay, yes, so it's the Second Amendment. Let's talk about bearing arms and what does that mean? Not only for you as a citizen of America, but also, we know it's different for everybody, but for you as a white man, tell us your perspective.
Well, so I'm going to pull up the Second Amendment right now. And I'm going to read it word for word. Now, for all the viewers out there, if the Second Amendment is something that people usually have a very strong opinion about, whether that be positive or negative, meaning for it or against it. So before everybody gets on their high horse and says, you know, every American should be able to own a rocket launcher, to the people who are like, guns are bad, guns are evil, guns kill people, I'm going to read the amendment and we're going to dissect it. All right. So a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So you asked, what does that mean for me as a white dude?
Yes.
That should not be the question, because people are not just white. So it's the right of the people. Well, the Second Amendment, well, yes, but the Second Amendment is a right for the white person just as much as it is a right for the black person or the Asian.
I would disagree to agree, but we can discuss that. Let's continue to discuss. Yeah.
Okay. So, right. But I have a right to own a gun just as much as you do. And that right shall not be infringed. So, I know history has, in our country, has disarmed people who weren't white, and that is not correct.
What do you mean by that?
That is that.
Tell me more, man. Tell me more.
Yeah. So throughout history, you know, after. So throughout history, let's start before the Emancipation Proclamation. Let's start before that. You know, black slaves were obviously not allowed to own guns because they weren't viewed as a whole person. They were slaves.
Tell the viewers out there what amendment is that, just so they can know.
It's the 13th or 14th. That is the 13th Amendment. And
3/5 of the person, to be exact. So we weren't even considered people. Is that so? Keep going.
Yeah. But after the 13th Amendment, now they're considered a whole person.
We'll talk more about that. Keep going.
Okay. So with that being said, I argue that once the 13th Amendment got passed, the First Amendment, the Second Amendment, all the other amendments became an equal playing field for both white people and people of color. If you go on paper, just look at the paper. Look at logic, look at the paper. Everybody has equal rights.
Interesting.
Right? Well, then, yeah. So my thing is that my right to own a firearm should not be because I'm white. Now, there's a stereotype that only white people love guns, and the black people who love guns are either police officers or gangbangers and drug dealers, you know?
Explain.
That's that. Yeah, because I've heard a lot of people saying that, like, well, as a black man, I don't own a gun because, you know, there's a stigma that comes with that. Like, a black man with a gun means that you're up to no good. And that's a stereotype. That's a huge stereotype. Just as on the other side, it's a stereotype that the only white people who like guns are racist rednecks who still think the Civil War is going on. And they go hunting and all that stuff. But the reality of the matter is that the Second Amendment is for everybody. Regardless if you're white, black, gay, straight. Yeah, white, black, gay, straight, Asian, Mexican, whatever. If you are a legal citizen of this country, also to go with that, you do not have a felony record. that right is for you. It's your right to protect your family as you see fit.
Yeah. Let me add to that point. I do, for the most part, agree with you, but there are some things which I do disagree with you on, which I'll explain now. So I do agree that, as you know, a legal citizen who was born in this country, whether you're, you know, black or Asian or Latino, you have the right to bear arms, and you have the right to, have that, you know, right to exercise. While at the same time that they state that in the Constitution, I would argue and I would push back on the fact that it is equal. And the reason why I say that, well, the reason I say that is because even though, yes, the Constitution was instituted during the Enlightenment period, and we still use it up to this point, there are some aspects of it that, you know, we go back to the amendment that talks about, you know, the right for us to all bear arms, you know, Amendment 13, and then also the amendment that, you know, we mentioned about, you know, blacks or slaves being 3/5 of a person. Now, they're not going to say that, you know, they're meaning that, but basically they're saying that we're people who are African or black descent are not basically people, they're animals. So basically that when they stated that back then in that period when they're creating an amendment, that's what it really meant, even though now we view it differently in this cultural context in this new age. So what I want to speak to, not only what you have said, Michael, you made some good points, and you know, I do respect and I do understand, you know, your perspective to the best of my ability. And so from my side of it, I just see that, yes, that is true. Like, guns are not just for one ethnic group, not just for, you know, white people or black people or any other ethnic group. Because I'll tell you this, Rex. When I went to college, I'll mind you guys, I went to college in a very rural country place. I stayed there for 3 years. It's in Georgia. Probably one of the most areas where there was a lot of people who were associated, who had traditions or who were associated with the Confederate flag, or people who were KK members or who were associated with that, or just the town that I was living in had that history. I would just say that. So when I was there, I learned a lot about the Southern white culture and just the Southern culture in general. And I found out that a lot of misconceptions or, you know, perceptions that I had were affirmed or were kind of, I would say kind of broken down. A combination of both. So when I say that, I've actually got a chance to see that not all white Southern people who have the tradition of believing about the Confederate flag, or believing in that tradition, or just believing about how would I say, the tradition of KKK or all that, they're not all bad people, you know, like all of us have good and bad in us. But so I learned that a lot by interacting with some of them and just being there. So when I say what I'm about to say, this is not a shot at anybody who comes from that culture, or just white culture in general, or just any other ethnic background. So I know many sides to this issue or this matter. I wouldn't call it an issue. I would just call it a discussion. When I say what I'm about to say, I would just say, as a black man, as African American in this society, not only have I had personal experiences with just seeing, you know, people who are in my family just you know, experience certain experiences where if they had, you know, a gun, or if they had something on it, they were questioned, or they were like basically interrogated because they had a weapon. Now, the stereotype that Mike was mentioned earlier is a real thing for black people more than any other race, I believe personally, because of the history in the country. And so when I say that, I can just clearly state what has already been seen in society. Police brutality, I would just say black men and women being shot because of their color of their skin, and because the cops are feeling intimidated, whatever you may want to call it, or trigger happy. But my fact is, when it comes to just a black person owning a gun in general, we're seen as a threat to society. Basically, when a black person or a black male specifically has a gun, we're seen as a threat to society. Now, on the other hand, for me personally, that doesn't stop me from bearing and exercising my work, right, personally. I believe in bearing arms. I believe in having that protection, because that is my right. But also, as a black man, I'm gonna say, I know what comes with that if I happen to get pulled over. I know what I have to do so I won't get shot and so I won't be dead. So there's a certain procedure, unfortunately, that black people and African Americans have to go through while driving when they have a weapon. So that's one thing. And then the last point I want to make about it is also about blacks having guns who are criminals. That can be a double standard, but it also can be a misconception. Like every black person or somebody who is mixed with black, or somebody who is a minority, but specifically a black person who has a gun, they think that we're gang bangers, drug dealers, and all that. That's not always true. So I do believe that just as much as there are other races of people who love guns, like white people, I believe there are other people of other ethnic backgrounds who like guns and stuff like that. So I guess those are the points I want to make as far as that. Anything you want to add?
Yeah, so I mean, that you're absolutely right. There's, if a cop pulls over a white guy with a gun who has the proper licensing to own that gun, and then the cop pulls over, let's say that same person was black, you are 100% right. There will probably be more skepticism with the cop pulling over the black person, or the black version of that person, which is it's bad. It's unfortunate. It's not right. So I know that the procedure for anybody who gets pulled over for a traffic violation, let's say, and they have a gun, when the cop runs that person's plates, that cop will be able to. So what a cop's procedure is a cop pulls you over, or the cop will just start running your plates before he pulls you over. He'll be tailgating you for like a couple minutes. So if a cop's tailgating you for a couple minutes, be prepared to get pulled over, because he's running your plates. So that way he can just get out of the car and talk to you. So you're not sitting there for 3 minutes, because the risk is if you're sitting there for 2-3 minutes, the cop's running your plates, you can just book it. You know, you can just leave.
That's their that's their concern. So cop pulls you over. Right when he runs your plates, he'll be able to tell if you have a concealed carry license or not. And it doesn't matter what state you're in. So if I were to have a concealed carry license in the state of Texas, right? And I get pulled over in Oklahoma. When the cop pulls me over, the cop will be able to know that I have a concealed carry permit from Texas. And I believe Oklahoma is a state where you can have a concealed carry permit from another state and still carry. Mm-hmm. So that being said, the cop already knows. He already knows that you have a permit. What he or she wants to see is that you're being honest with them. So the proper procedure is put your hands on the wheel, 10 and 2, because the cop knows that you're packing heat, most likely. So what you do is you say, all right, officer knocks on your window. Do you know why I pulled you over this afternoon? No, I don't. I just wanted to say, officer, that I do have a concealed carry permit. My firearm is, hypothetically, let's say my firearm is on my right hip. I have not gotten my wallet out yet. The magic words for the officer, how do you want me to proceed, or how do you want me to continue? That tells the officer that you're being compliant and you're wanting to keep and maintain the safety of both yourself and the officer. If the cop pulls you over, you have a concealed carry permit, and you tell the officer, and you don't let the officer know that you're carrying, that is reason for him to not trust you. So regardless of if you agree with that or not, that is what they teach everybody in a concealed carry class. If and when you get pulled over and you're carrying, you let the officer know that, one, you have a permit, and two, that you're carrying and where the gun is. That's for everyone.
It is.
But also, I do want to note with that, that is a valid point according to the law. When it comes to just, situations that have happened where we're here in America, right? And basically what has happened is there has been somebody who does follow the procedures. Like, let's just say, for example, put a person who is African-American in the situation. Because this is what, most of the situations where somebody gets killed happens to us, the average person. So we'll just put this person in a situation. The cop comes and, does stuff that, Mike is stating. He, tells, follows procedure and tells them that I have this and that. Eventually, the cop, feels some type of way, and he either tells the person to step out of the car and, starts, I guess, interrogating them or questioning them when they have already told them I have this. Or the other narrative is, just to shoot the person, so for me, in my perspective, everybody is entitled to perspective, so I respect my perspective for that, his perspective, but also he has some valid points in perspective as far as the law and procedure, so I do agree with that, but also I have my own perspective, just being a black male in America, and that perspective is, on the other side of it, is just, I would say, comes to the point where, when a black person gets stopped for just, African American stuff, it's a lot worse than for anybody else. They naturally assume that we're trying to do something that we're not trying to do. And so they react out of, I guess, instinct, or they react out of what they may, presume that may be happening. They either shoot somebody, or they just, act out of line, and then it's another, life dead. So, there's some cases that, Trayvon Martin, you can say, Philando Castro, and so many, Sandra Bland, you can go look these up. These cases have happened to people who have followed procedure, or let's say they didn't say anything, to the cop, because they know if they say anything, then they know that they could possibly lose their life. You know, so there's two sides to it. Like, I understand that you have to follow the procedure of the law, but also for certain people in this country, if they do follow that procedure and they do tell the cops, I have a gun and I have a license, then that will give them a reason to just kill them or shoot them or take their life. So they don't say anything.
So I would be very, I'd be very cautious on, I mean, unless you have like statistics, I would be very cautious as to say that it's every cop's natural instinct just to shoot the person. If a black guy says, hey, I have a concealed carry permit, the gun is in my glove compartment, or the gun is on my right hip, I'd be hesitant. I'm not saying that you're wrong, but what I'm saying is I'd be very hesitant to say that all cops are going to be trigger happy because Shaquan has a gun versus, you know, Nathaniel having a gun, you know?
I mean,
so,
go ahead, bro. I mean, I get what you're saying.
I'd be a little bit more hesitant on that. I have a buddy who's a cop in a suburb right outside of Chicago. And I've talked to him about this before, and he's a rookie. So he's still a greenhorn. He's still pretty new at this whole thing. But he's told me situations where, well, not situations. I've asked him, I'm like, how are you going to react if you pull over a white guy who tells you the exact same thing as the black guy does, and they will tell you literally word for word, you know, officer, I have a concealed carry permit. It's in my wallet. My gun is at this spot. I asked him, I'm like, how do you react? And he says, a lot of what he actually is saying is, what the person is telling the officer. But two, I mean, as long as they say, like, if they're honest and they're saying, hey, look, I have a permit, it's legal. And let me remind you, the cop already knows when he runs your plates. When he runs your plates, he already knows if you have a concealed carry permit. Because it shows up on there, because everything is under the state police medium. So he's already gonna know. And so if you come clean, my buddy said, he's like, I'll be a lot more relaxed in that situation versus if the person doesn't tell me, regardless of race. I've asked other cops too, for example, when Illinois came out with concealed carry, I would be at a gas station, I would just ask a cop, hey, if I get this and I get pulled over, what do I do? And then I would also ask a truth bomb with the cop, like, hey, if my best friend who's African American does the same thing, the cop said, the cop knew what I was getting at. And the cop said, look, as long as the person tells us right away, the police should be more relaxed in that situation. I'm not saying that there aren't dirty cops out there, especially in different parts of this country. But what I am saying is that at the end of the day, the Second Amendment belongs to everybody. It doesn't just belong to the hillbilly white dude, you know, in Tennessee. It belongs to everyone. The great thing about this country is that the Second Amendment belongs to all of us. There's a movement going around right now called Black Guns Matter, and to give you some context on it, it means, yes, guns for African Americans do matter, but it also is saying that the guns that the people are wanting to get rid of are the ones that are black. The AR-15, the scary looking ones. I was looking it up right now. It was the founder of this. Maj, I can't pronounce this for the life of me. The first name is M-A-J, last name is spelled T-O-U-R-E. So I want to say Maj Torre. He's an African American that looks like he's a gun nut like me. And he's, you know, the Run DMC t-shirts.
He's got that same format, and it says Black Lives Matter. And so, Maj, M-A-J, and then last name is Tori, T-O-U-R-E. Maj Tor, or Maj Tori, or something like that. He's from Philly. I think he's a rapper, too. And his platform is gun control is racist. So, actually, to give you guys kind of a history lesson here, one of the NRA's first major cases when it was founded was protecting the rights of a freed slave way back then, like 1800s. So protecting, like going to court, protecting the rights of a freed slave who shot someone who like broke into his house or someone. Well, the guy shot, the freed slave shot, killed the guy, and they arrested him. And then the NRA came in and defended this guy and got him out of jail. So actually, okay, one of the NRA...
Let the viewers know, me know where we can find that information here today.
Yeah, let me...
So why are you finding that? How would this respond back to your point so far that you've said? So it's not the fact that I don't agree as far as the constitutional right in general, but it's the fact that yes, I do believe that they're intending to have that nationwide and statewide for everybody. But when it comes actual down to the situation, yes, there are, you know, good cops and bad cops. You know, like, just to be honest with you, I've had interactions and talks with good and bad cops. You know, I've had run-ins where I've been harassed by, you know, bad cops. But I've also had conversations with good cops, and they've told me about certain things. So when I say this, I'm not a person that's against cops. I'm not against, you know, the whole, I guess, movement of cops. But I'm just telling you as the viewers, and I'm just stating in the podcast that there are situations where, yes, you know, somebody gets pulled over. And let's say it's, you know, it's a white person that gets pulled over. Now, 9 times out of 10, whether they're a good cop or bad cop or in between, yes, even if, you know, this person, well, let's say the white person tells them I have with them, like, you know, and yeah, like Mike said, they can look it up in the system or they can disregard that. But most of the time, when, let's say, this person who is getting pulled or who is white, yes, they immediately let that person go without any further questions. So let's look at that. And then also, let's say if there's a person in the car, right, who is white and black, okay? There's, you know, they're going to ask you a lot of questions, more than usual, because you have somebody who is black in there. Now, if it was just a white person, it would be different. But if there was a white person and a black person, they'll ask, okay, what's your association with this person, right? Or how do you know this person? They may ask questions like that. But let's split the other side of this perspective. So what if it's just a black person or two black people or a group of black people, right? Then obviously if these people in the car who are black at this point, they're telling, like, hey, like, I have the license, I have the gun, and they're being forthcoming and honest. I'm not saying that, you know, honesty is not good, but I'm just saying that in certain situations, being black, it could cost you your life if you're overly honest with the cop. Because yes, I do believe in general, as people, you know, just outside of race and ethnicity, just as people and citizens, we should be honest and forthcoming. But at the same time, when you put ethnicity back into the picture, that makes it more harder to kind of determine how the cops will respond or how they could respond. It's kind of like pretty much predictable because of what has happened. So I guess that's my point to what, you know, Mike is saying. Yeah, man. He mentioned about this guy, Maj Tore. Mike, let me ask you your perspective on that. Have you watched any of his videos or seen what type of perspective he was coming from or watched any articles to see what the movement was about? Tell me.
Yeah, I've watched a little bit. I watched a little bit of his stuff. From what I understand, is that his main goal is to educate the black community that a black person owning a gun doesn't just mean that they're a gangbanger, you know, because that's the stereotype. Apparently that's the stereotype. So his thing is more on educating people from the black community that like they have a right to own a gun just as much as anybody else does. And as Americans, like the same logic that tells us you're an American, go vote. You know, as an American, you have the right to vote, so go vote. It's the same thing. You're an American, and you know, as long as you follow the correct procedures, just like voting, if you have the right to go own a gun, go own a gun. If you want to, like if you have interest in it, don't feel like that just because it's a taboo subject that you shouldn't go educate yourself about it and make the decision for yourself. His main thing is don't let society choose for you whether you should own a gun or not. You should do the research yourself, and regardless of what race you are, to decide if owning a gun is right for you or not. I mean, it's your right. I mean, I know they're expensive, and I would never suggest buying a cheap gun. Once, and I hate that thing. I wish. It's your right. It's your right as an American citizen. If you're within the law, meaning if you know you have no felony convictions and blah blah blah, and you're a decent citizen, go out and buy a gun. Learn the safety procedures with it. Learn how to operate it. Go to the shooting range once every other month or something like that. You know, it's your right, regardless of what your skin color is. And that's the main thing I've been trying to communicate is, I mean, yeah, the cops are the cops. And there are some dirty cops, there are some good cops. But that being said, that should not stop anybody from taking an interest in firearms that they have, if they have an interest in that. You know, at the same time, I think it would be unwise to go out and buy 75 different guns because, okay, now you're just wasting resources. But if you want to go out and buy a gun for protection, you have the right to do so. Go do it.
Right. So along with those points you make, I do agree with certain points, and I do disagree. But hey, that's indifferent. I just want to ask you a few more questions before we close out our segment. So with this guy Maj Touré, would you say, question one, would you say that his motive of doing what he's doing is good, or would you say it's bad, or you know, neutral? How would you view, based on your perspective, what you have watched on this guy, and you know, watch his articles. What have you seen, and what's your perspective?
From what I've seen is, okay, so he's not that he's not as popular as some of the other like African American gun activists that I've come across, and the fact that he's not as popular tells me that he's probably not taking money from people, you know, like under the table political money, which is a good thing. So there's that, but I think it's coming from a good spot, you know. I mean, he's definitely some people in his community are definitely kind of eyeing him like, what is this dude doing? Like, why is this black guy like promoting more black people to own guns? Blah blah blah, you know. But I think it's coming from a good spot. Overall, like if it's mostly on educating people, I mean, yeah, that's good.
Definitely, man. Thank you for the insight, man. Yeah, I guess I had two more questions. So when you look at just the government, because we know as far as owning guns and having own gunners, let me restate that. Let's look at the government. And let's look at the system that has systematically put together certain, you know, structures in society. And let's ask ourselves, is the bearing arms amendment for the citizens that are, you know, legally born in this society, no matter what race you are. What basically the question I would want us all to ask, or I would want to ask them, the government, is be like, so if you stated this in an amendment, and if this is a clear right, as we see, you know, we're allowed to do these as citizens in general, no matter your ethnic background, then what do you think systematically the government, even though they've said it in the Constitution, why do you think that there's so many things in our society that either turn in the direction of that constitutional right being the way it is or not? So basically what I'm talking about, the New World Order, like, what are your thoughts on that, according to just in general the gun laws and, you know, what the government fought to destabilize the nation, as a conspiracy theory, or maybe a reality? Speak on that.
Okay. So, in regards to the New World Order, I don't have a lot of knowledge on it, so I don't want to say something that I don't know. And I don't want to say, like, they're trying to do X, Y, and Z if I truly don't know. But I know the New World Order is in the camp of a conspiracy theory, too. So it could be true, it could not be true. I mean, regardless if it is true or is not true, I'm not going to talk about it, because I don't know. But when it comes to, I can say this, when it comes to the government and trying to take away people's guns, which is what I think they're trying to do. When a government tries to take away people's guns, they do it for power reasons. One of the very first things that Adolf Hitler did when he came to power is he disarmed the people. And he said something to the long lines of, you know, you can trust your government. We're going to be there to protect you guys. You don't need to rely on yourselves. And then he went out and killed millions of his own people. Millions of Jews who were German citizens.
Hold on. Before you move forward, let's note that, you know, Hitler wasn't even Jewish, though. You know, he's from, what's that name? Austria. Yeah,
he was from Austria. And so there's that. Stalin disarmed the people. Same thing. He put the undesirables, or like the medically challenged, in gulags, which are the same thing as concentration camps, and they all died. Not all of them died, but most of them died. Stalin actually killed more people than Hitler did. But no one talks about that.
You talking about Joseph?
Who else is there? I mean,
Russia, right?
Yeah, Russia. Yeah. So, good old communism for you guys. Anyway, next point. Any form of gun control is in the term gun control. The government is trying to control the people. And they go on a platform of, well, we're doing this to protect you. We're doing this to protect our schools. And I argue, like, we protect our politicians with guns. We protect our nation militaristically with guns. We protect our police with guns. But we protect our children with a sign that says gun-free zone. And I'm not trying to make an argument to arm the teachers, but what I'm saying is, why don't we have armed guards outside of schools? If the schools are being targets, why don't we have that? You know, why is it that someone can just walk into a school no problem in the first place? I mean, we protect our airports with guns, but we protect our schools with signs that say no guns allowed? Are you kidding me? These are our children. These are our future. And I'm not saying, you know, little Jimmy, who's in sixth grade, should have an AK-47 in his backpack. That's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying arm everybody in the school, but I'm saying let's take some people who are getting out of the military and looking for a job, let's have them, you know, sign a 2-year contract or whatever to, you know, just help protect our schools. You know? Or maybe let's get more school cops, you know, standing outside the doors. Why are our school security guards these people who are, one, I'm sorry, a lot of them are out of shape, and two, they're not armed. Why don't we train school security guards or come up with a school security task force to have a gun strapped on them, and that in case anything happens, they can take care of business.
Right. You make a very valid point, and that's a good question.
And if it's because, well, it may be intimidating to some of the kids, this is wrapping it all around again to the demasculation of men. I'm sorry. Boys like guns.
True.
I don't care who you are. Boys are the ones who go outside in the middle of the summer, they pick up a stick, they say, hey, this looks like a bazooka, and then you go down the street in your neighborhood and you go hunting for your best friend. All right?
Yeah. For sure.
I don't care what anybody says. Boys like guns. So to wrap up the whole gun topic, saying guns aren't bad, people are bad. If I were to take a fully loaded AR-15, you know, put the magazine in, not the clip, it's called a magazine. You put the magazine in, you rack the slide, you cock it, and all you have to do is pull the trigger. And I set that gun down on a table and nothing, and nobody touches
fact,
it,
fact,
that gun will not go off. So there's no way that gun's going off. So the fact of the matter is that, yeah, at the same time, I love guns. I think they're great. I think that we're very blessed to be able to own them. At the same time, yeah, if I do believe in background checks, and I do believe that if you want to, just like you want to drive a car, just like you want to vote, if you want to own a gun, yeah, have to go through a background check. That's fine. Totally cool with that. But at the same time, for some politician to get up on a platform and tell me or anybody else that I, for them to dictate my rights, I'm sorry, that's not America.
Back.
And that's the same for a white person, that's the same for a black person, that's the same for the Asian and the Mexican. You know, if, you know, Dimitri, I assume you have no felony convictions, and if you were to tell me that you were going to go down to a gun store and you were going to go out and buy an AK-47 and you were going to buy 500 rounds of ammo,
yeah, and I
would
do
say
it
go
too,
for it.
If I had money. for real.
That's the other thing. Those things are expensive. Hey. They're very expensive. So
point very well taken.
Yeah, so that's my view on all that.
Well, hey, on that note, you guys, we're gonna have to unfortunately end because of time, but I thank you, viewers, for out there listening to our conversation, and I thank my guest and my friend Mike for coming on. All right, God bless.
All right, you too. God bless.